Good evening, everyone. My name is Doris Lill, and I'm the Client Education Manager for the National MS Society. I want to thank you for joining us on today's telelearning tips for people with MS and their partners, planning for the future. We know that planning for the future can be tough, but obviously you're here because you recognize the importance of doing so. Today, you will learn about the legal and financial considerations critical for partners and people living with MS. Following the presentation, there will be time for questions and answers. Today's presentation is also being recorded and will be available on our website. Let me introduce today's presenters. Dick Bell is owner of Bell Financial, providing insurance and financial services to a wide variety of businesses and individuals for over 40 years. He spearheaded the Financial Education Partners Pro Bono Project as past president of the Society of Financial Service Professionals, connecting people with MS with certified financial planners in their community. Dick was the recipient of the Society's Volunteer of the Year Award in 2013. He works and resides in Calabasas, California, and enjoys race walking and tennis. Practicing law for over 30 years, Brad Fragon is a certified elder law attorney with extensive experience in estate planning, elder law, special needs planning, probate, and tax matters. Brad serves as president of the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys, board member of the Special Needs Alliance, and a board member of the Colorado Fund for People with Disabilities. In addition to his practice, Brad is an adjunct professor at Stetson University College of Law and author of numerous publications, who has been quoted in the Wall Street Journal, MS Money, Kiplinger Retirement Report, and Bloomberg. Now I will turn over this presentation to Dick.
Well, thank you, Doris, and welcome, everybody. You know, financial planning means different things to different people, but for tonight's purpose, let's say that financial planning is directing your limited resources to meeting your highest priority goals. Making sure you have enough income is applicable for both the person with MS in case they have to leave the workforce prematurely, you know, but also for the care partner who may have to reduce their work hours or take a lower-paying job. You build up an emergency fund by living on less than you have coming in each month, and then that becomes an investment fund. And the ideal scenario is to not have a mortgage when your earned income ceases. Now, our primary sources of income are either us at work or money at work. Your earning power is your greatest asset. It's not your house, and it's not your 401k balance. Your money at work will include various types of retirement plans, where you take some money from your current lifestyle today and you send it into the future for the older person you will be someday. Non-retirement investments like stocks, bonds, mutual funds, rental property, they're all sources of unearned income, but they're very important. You may not consider disability insurance to be an investment, but it's a great source of replacing income when you cannot work. A little bit later, Brad's going to discuss Social Security disability income and supplemental security income, and they're important benefits. It may surprise you to know that one in seven retirees gets 100% of their income from Social Security. It's not surprising to any of us that somebody with MS may not be able to work a full eight-hour day or work all the way to a normal retirement age. This affects your ability to save, to pay off debt, to maximize your Social Security benefits, to build up retirement benefits, et cetera. And look at the cost of MS drugs. I just checked something today, Medicare Part D, $4,200 a month for Copaxone. And you know you need insurance. And depending on the course of the disease, someone may require additional care in the future. The care partner is also affected by the potential loss of the second income, and they may have challenges in their own job where they'll have needs to take time off on short notice or to have to reduce work hours to care for their partner. The most critical part of getting ahead financially is to live on less than you have coming in each month. You may not be able to affect your income immediately, but you can certainly affect your spending. Here's a tip. Go back through your checking account and credit cards for the past 3 months and highlight the items that you really did not need to buy. would you be just as happy to have that money in the bank? And a second tip, pay cash for items that are less than a certain dollar amount, such as $10 or $20. You know, it's proven that people who pay cash spend 11 to 17% less than those who use credit cards. With a credit card, see, you never really feel the pain when you buy something. And tip three, don't go shopping without a list of what you want to buy. If you see something that you would like, and you know we're all subject to impulse buying, particularly at places like Costco, don't buy it, but add it to the list for another shopping day. And when that day comes, you'll be surprised how many items you've determined you really don't need. How much are you paying in non-deductible credit card interest each month or year? Are you afraid to look, or are you ashamed to look? I would argue that not paying $500 in interest is the same as having $500 more in savings. So focus on paying off credit cards and then save those dollars in the bank or a credit union. Ideally, you'll get to the point where you're maxing out your 401k contributions each year. At least contribute enough to get the employer matching dollars. Increase your contributions with every raise, or increase your contribution by 1% each year. That's a great New Year's resolution to get you jump-started. Finally, take the time to understand your employee benefits. It bears repeating that your earning power is your greatest asset. Your savings and investments are designed to help you eventually replace your earned income. I'll go into more depth about employee benefits in a moment, but make sure you understand your benefits under the Family Medical Leave Act. And while we have a pretty good knowledge of our employee benefits, most folks really don't understand Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, etc., and how these various safety net programs apply to them and their families. You know, we're raised to be competitive. You know, imagine playing basketball, golf, bridge, or any other game and not keeping score. How would you know if you're winning? You know, or even improving? A personal financial statement is a financial scorecard. It's a quick summary of your assets and your liabilities, what you own and what you owe. And your only competition here is the person you were last year. I maintain such a scorecard on a quarterly basis since 1991. It can be done on a big piece of graph paper, but I use an Excel spreadsheet. Why quarterly, you may ask? Well, our 401k and our other retirement plan statements are typically quarterly. And four times a year, I'm forced to review my financial position to face reality, whether I like it or not. So I've listed these major categories on my scorecard. You know, savings is a listing of your bank accounts, checking accounts, credit union accounts, etc. It's cash I can get my hands on quickly, and here's where I have my emergency fund. The retirement category is self-explanatory. 401k plans are kind of boring until you have the equivalent of 1 year's income in your account. And now you'll start to pay attention and be proud of your progress as your pot grows. Other investments are non-retirement funds, such as stocks, bonds, mutual funds, rental property, things that provide income or can be converted into income. I value my house as an asset equal to what I paid for the house, the purchase price, plus improvements. You know, it's fun watching the mortgage balance drop each quarter. Success breeds and encourages more success. That's why you keep the scorecard. The what you owe part of the scorecard includes the credit cards. List them individually and put the interest rate next to the name of the card. That will help you focus on paying off cards that cost the most. Other debts may include car loans, school loans, you know, loans from mom and dad, etc. So we're close to the end of the year. Why not start your financial scorecard on December 31st as a present to yourself? You'll be glad you did. An emergency fund gives you peace of mind. You create one by consuming less than you have coming in each month. Shoot for building up 3 months of your living expenses in savings. That fund helps you through a temporary disability, you know, the hot water heater that finally stops working in your house, etc. These emergencies always come up. Put the most you can into retirement plans. I've never met a retiree who said to me, "Hey, Dick, you know, I really have too much money for retirement." I should have squandered more as I went along. You know, what was I thinking? Set money aside in advance for big annual outlays. My property taxes are due in December. Starting last December, I took 1/12 of that bill out of my income each month. This December, I'll have more than enough to pay that bill. So I'm going to be paying tomorrow's bill with yesterday's income. Too many people slide into paying yesterday's bills with tomorrow's income. Overpaying on a mortgage really makes sense after you meet your other objectives. Just remember that extra money that you put into your house is money that's tied up. You can't get to it without refinancing the house, but it sure feels great to see that mortgage interest payment drop every month or every quarter. Finally, invest on a regular basis. That's called dollar cost averaging, because you're buying more shares when the market is down. I know it's tough to do psychologically, but it really makes sense. Regular investing is why 401k plans work so well. Now, everybody has a pretty good idea of their health insurance benefits, deductibles, co-payments, co-insurance, etc. You're going to have some out-of-pocket costs for medical care each month or each year. I suggest you set aside a certain portion of each paycheck into a fund to pay medical bills. If you're fortunate enough to have bought an individual disability insurance policy before you were diagnosed with MS, it's solid gold. If you're the care partner of somebody with MS, you ought to take a serious look at buying disability insurance. It protects your paycheck. Now, it's also possible your employer offers group long-term disability insurance, or you've had access to buying a plan at work regardless of your health. Buy it. And then read about what you need to do to qualify for benefits, how much you will get, you know, typically 60% of pay, when it will start, and how long you will get payments. That's what you need to understand about disability insurance. And understand the investment alternatives in your 401k plan. We see too many people who are afraid of losing their money, so they put their contributions into the low-earning money market fund. Retirement plans for long-term savings, and you need compound interest working for you. You're in a marathon. Don't get too wildly excited or disappointed about where you are at the 200-meter mark. Take more chances in retirement plans, particularly if you're younger. If you have a chance to buy employer-sponsored long-term care insurance, get the maximum you can get. Multiple sclerosis will automatically preclude you from an individual long-term care insurance policy, and that's a reason why your co-partner should really consider long-term care insurance for himself or herself. And we've seen recently some forward-thinking employers are offering more benefits for caregivers, time off, etc. Know what's available to you. Check your benefits out. How about getting money from your house? Your house is a major asset, but your money's tied up in it. Consider downsizing as you get older. If you were moving, you'd find a lot of stuff to get rid of. If it has value, consider selling it on eBay. If you don't know how to do that, your kids sure do. Many folks have rented out a home in their house to generate income. And if one of your children has done well, consider selling your house to them and renting it back. This could be a win-win deal. You get cash with which you can make future payments and improve your style of living, and your child gets an asset with a built-in trustworthy tenant. As a last resort, and I really mean this as a last resort, you may consider a reverse mortgage, but be careful of the fees. They can really be ugly. So what do we take away from this? Start and update a financial scorecard quarterly. Examine where your money's been going, and you'll find some things that really were not necessary. Somebody once said that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing again and again, hoping for different results. So do something different tomorrow, such as setting up an automatic transfer from each paycheck into your credit union. If you heard something of value tonight, put it to use immediately. Make something happen. It's your life. So with that, let me turn this over to Brad Fragone, who isn't just a top-notch elder law attorney. He's the president of the 4,500-member National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys. So listen up. Brad, the microphone's yours.
Thank you very much, Dick. And thank you, everyone, for listening tonight. And the part of my program that I want to talk about is that, you know, we can divide this into about four parts here. The first part I'm going to talk about is the legal documents that everybody needs to have in place and what the specifics are for those legal documents. And then we're going to talk about, you know, what type of benefits that are available to you for that may pay you a monthly amount. We're going to talk about the programs that pay for what we call long-term care and how those programs work. And then we're going to talk about some various trusts that you should know about and how those trusts work. So let's look at, you know, the key legal documents that you need to have to make sure that you have in order. And the first two at the top there are, you know, a healthcare directives and a financial power of attorney. These are what we call lifetime documents that you utilize during your lifetime, meaning that you're going to, you know, but when you pass away, these documents stop and then your will or trust would take over at that point in time. So you need to make sure that you have all of those legal documents in order there too. We'll be talking about your financial affairs and how to pay for long-term care. Dick has talked about some great advice about investing your money and how to get your financial affairs in order here. So we talked about the documents that we needed here, and we need to make sure too, once you have those documents, that you keep everything up to date. You make sure that you understand about how your property is owned, how the beneficiary designation's in there. But for most of us, we need to get what's going to happen when we pass away, but also we need to focus on what's going to occur during our lifetime and what's going to be what documents we need to have in place at that point in time. So on the next slide there, you're going to see that we have, you know, we have to name what we call decision makers, what we call fiduciary. A decision maker under a power of attorney is the agent named under the power of attorney. You're going to give that person the authority to make healthcare decisions or financial decisions. A trustee of a trust, an executor in a will. Those are all what we call fiduciaries or decision makers. And we also, no matter how good your document may be, you need to make sure that you have a good decision maker in place. Because if you have a bad decision maker, it doesn't matter if those documents are right. They're not going to make the right decisions for you. But you need, if you do have a decision maker, you need an up-to-date document so they can do their job properly. And then you got to make sure that the ownership of your property is coordinated with all this to make everything sure everything does go smoothly. So who should be our decision makers? Well, we need to make sure we educate them. They need to understand what their duties are. You need to designate in your document when they take over, at what point in time. Is it upon when you sign the document, or is it a time when you have a medical diagnosis that you no longer have mental capacity to make decisions about there? Sometimes your decision makers, your agents, those people that you name, they need to understand that they have liability for acting, and they need to make sure that they get proper advice so they can make the right decisions for you. A lot of times family members are the appropriate people to make decisions on our behalf, but sometimes we have situations where we need to hire a professional fiduciary. And those professional fiduciaries are out there, so if you were talking to your attorney, they can give you advice about what your alternatives are in that area. For healthcare power of attorney, again, this is going to give you, your agent, the authority to make healthcare decisions on your behalf. You got to make sure when you do that that your agent understands what you want accomplished if you can't communicate with that. You need to make sure that your healthcare power of attorney has what we call a HIPAA provision. That HIPAA provision is an authority for your medical provider to release medical information to them. And if you're going to give your agent the authority to make end-of-life decisions, you need to make sure that you have that conversation with them. Or if you want to have another document that designates that, you need to make sure that you've talked to your attorney about what the difference is in those documents and make sure that your agent understands what your decision, what your wishes are. For a financial power of attorney, that's a power of attorney. You can combine these in one document, but it's generally recommended that you have separate documents, because sometimes the person we want making healthcare decisions for us is not the same person that we want to make sure that we're doing our financial affairs. And again, what those documents do is it makes sure that we don't have to go into court to get a guardian conservator for you. A financial power of attorney will allow us to avoid court proceedings for you. The word durable means that it will continue even if you are determined to be incapacitated. So that's why you see that word financial durable power of attorney, meaning that it will continue after you're determined to be incapacitated. And it's important that these documents list very specific proceedings, but you also need to make sure that you know your agent and they understand what the responsible responsibilities are under that document. So what should be in a financial power of attorney? You know, we want to have banking powers. We want to have these very specific lists of authorities, because if we don't list these specific authorities, then you can get into a situation where the document is rejected by a bank or a financial institution, by a title company or whatever financial institution we're trying to do. They're going to look for very specific language in that document. We also want to make sure we name a successor agent, or we also want to understand that sometimes naming all of our children as the agent, you know, will create more problems that as co-agents, will create more problems than it will solve, because they may not all agree in all of these decisions. And sometimes you can get a conflict between the healthcare power of attorney and the financial power of attorney, that they're making opposite decisions for you. Your healthcare power of attorney may be arranging all this care for you, but your agent under the financial power of attorney is refusing to pay for it. So you want to make sure your documents address this issue and address who's going to have the ultimate authority for those type of decisions. So now we're going to switch from the legal documents, and of course it's always important that you have your will and your trust completed and talk to your attorney about that, but you should always remember that my primary focus as an elder law attorney is to make sure that you're taken care of during your lifetime. And one of those next steps is to talk to you about what type of government benefits are out there for you. So when you see that these entitlement programs, what we call programs that you're entitled to if you have paid into the system, then there's also needs-based programs that you're entitled to if you have a financial need. So under the entitlement program, that would be like your Social Security. And also there's another entitlement program called Social Security Disability, or SSDI. And that's based upon the amount of work credits if you paid into the system. And if you become disabled, and disabled is defined under the statute as that you're unable to engage in substantial gainful employment, then you're going to be awarded Social Security disability. And that's going to be a portion of what your Social Security would be when you turn 65. And also, obviously, too, if you were entitled to Social Security, if you take early retirement at age 63 or at age 63 or delay it to age later on. Needs-based programs are Social Security income, supplemental security income. And that's a needs-based, so that's going to be pay you a monthly amount. You need to meet the definition of disabled, but you also must meet the financial eligibility requirements with that. Also, there is a VA aid in attendance that it's not related to a service-related disability, but if you served in the military during a time of war, even though you didn't, you know, do any active duties in combat, you or your widow may be entitled to a VA aid in attendance benefit. Now, also, when it's also important to make sure that we, you know, when you have a situation, we always want to make sure that we have health insurance. Now, Dick talked about to make, you know, if you had health insurance under your group health plan with your employer and understanding what your benefits with regard to that. You know, with the Affordable Care Act, then that makes sure that everybody can purchase health insurance. Now, health insurance, if under the Health Affordable Care Act, you may be entitled to certain subsidies to help you pay for that insurance, but there's no pre-existing requirements unlike there used to be, so you're always assured that you can get health insurance. And for those Medicaid subsidies that you can receive under the Affordable Care Act, that's strictly based upon your income. They don't care what your assets are, but your income will determine if you're entitled to certain subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. So again, but what does health insurance pay for? Health insurance pays for doctor's hospitalization prescriptions, if you need some rehab, if you fall and hurt yourself. But what it doesn't pay for is what, you know, if you need assistance in your home or if you would need to go to a facility. It's not going to pay for that with limited exceptions. Now, how do we pay for what we call long-term care or assistance in our home or assistance in a payment if we're in an assisted living or nursing home? So, you know, there's private pay, and that obviously means that's coming out of your pocket from your savings. Long-term care insurance, again, if you already have a diagnosis of MS, you're not going to be able to obtain long-term care insurance. We're going to talk about Medicaid and Medicare, and I always say that those programs that I'm sure it was a good idea to name them similar names at the time, but now it very much confuses people. And I mentioned VA benefits, and we'll talk about that briefly also. So Medicare, how do we become eligible for Medicare? Well, you know, when you turn age 65, and you don't have to be getting Social Security, but if you're getting Social Security, you know, then you're going to be entitled to Medicare. Also, if you are receiving Social Security disability payments, receiving what we just talked about, after, you know, you have to be disabled for 5 months and then you can make application. Now, it can take a long time to get your SSDI application approved, but after 24 months from receiving Social Security, your award date of your Social Security disability, then you're going to become eligible for Medicare. So you could conceivably be in your 20s and receiving the same type of Medicare that somebody is receiving when they're 65. And remember, Social Security disability and Medicare, they don't care how much money that you have. They're not going to ask you if you have how much money you have in your bank. Basically, Bill Gates, once if he was, you know, injured or he turned 65, he's going to get Medicare and he's going to get Social Security just like you and I will. But again, Medicare, with limited exceptions, is not going to pay for any in-home care assistance, and it's not going to pay for anything that you would need in a long-term care facility, with limited exceptions, and that's a 20-day, if you're discharged out of a hospital, it will pay 20 days in full, and maybe another 80 days there'll be a copay. Your copay is either out of your own pocket or from a supplemental policy. But again, Medicare eligibility is an entitlement program. It's not a financially needs-based program. So let's look at Medicaid. Medicaid is the program that's going to pay for, you know, depending on your state, in-home services, assisted living, nursing home. Again, it'll be very state-specific on what the Medicaid will, what services and what type of programs it'll pay for. There's all sorts of Medicaid programs, and each Medicaid program will have its own financial eligibility rules. And it's going to be based upon your income, and it's going to be based upon your assets, and it's going to be based upon whether you meet the medical definition that you require care. So it's important that you talk to an attorney in your state that they can explain those specific financial eligibility rules for you for the specific Medicaid program that you will be applying for. So when you talk about Medicaid, you're going to hear these terms. You're going to hear things we call, you know, a medical test. You medically require care. You can access Medicaid through SSI. if you qualify for SSI, you will automatically qualify for Medicaid. But you will also, you know, have to understand there's limitations on how much income you can have. There's limitations on how much assets you will have. Again, that's dependent upon the Medicaid program that you're going to pay for. But we'll be talking about what we call exempt assets and the certain types of trusts that you can have. So those assets are not counted for against you in determining your Medicaid eligibility. And also on long-term care Medicaid and certain Medicaid programs, if you have a spouse, that spouse is allowed to keep a certain amount of assets and a certain amount of income. So it's not necessary with a husband and wife, unless you're on SSI, for you to go bankrupt to qualify for Medicaid. And it's important to understand what we call those spousal protection provisions. And in Colorado, we have a spousal protection provision that would allow a spouse to keep $117,000. You will also have to understand that you can't give away property, that you have to, if you do give away property, then you're going to be in a situation where you may not be able to receive Medicaid because you gave away assets. And for long-term care Medicaid, we have what we call a five-year rule. And you, again, have to consult with an attorney in your state to make sure that you don't fall into that where you transfer away assets and render yourself ineligible for Medicaid because you gave property away. Now, it's always okay to give property between spouses, but when you give property away to somebody other than a spouse, such as a child, then Medicaid may say you can't receive services because of that gift. And also, too, under certain Medicaid programs, after you pass away, now, again, there's very specific rules for that. There may be what we call estate recovery. Now, if you have a spouse and you did everything right, that estate recovery is not going to occur if your spouse survives you. The estate recovery would only occur after, you know, that you, as the Medicaid recipient, passed away. But again, that would be if you had a surviving spouse, estate recovery would not occur. So we've been talking about, you know, these, you know, again, we have to go through all of these financial eligibility rules. And under Medicaid, we have what we call exempt assets. When I say exempt assets, that the basic rule for about all Medicaid programs is that the person applying, they can only have $2,000 worth of assets. But when we divide your assets into two separate columns, and the column we talk about on what we call exempt, meaning we don't care what that column adds up to. So when we're adding up that column, we don't care if, you know, it's, you know, if it's over $2,000. So the exempt property, the part that doesn't count towards your $2,000, is your home. That's not counted as an asset. All the stuff every weekend, you know, Dick discounted you about not going out and buying stuff, but all that stuff that we do buy and we put into our home, that doesn't count no matter how much what the value of it is. You can go out and purchase an irrevocable burial plan to make sure that that's all taken care of when you pass away. You know, of course, the $2,000. If you're under long-term care Medicaid, then we have all of those spousal allowance provision, and depending on your state, then that can be up to $117,000, $120,000. Some states are much less, some are more. And then certain trust assets are not counted. So what's over in the what we count is everything else. So if you have, you know, a bank account, you have an investment account, you have gold bars stashed underneath your bed, then all of those will be countable assets. So we either have to switch the ownership of your assets to your spouse or convert your countable property into exempt property. So we're going to talk about, when we talk about trust, how we can do that under certain situations. So I mentioned VA. Now, Veterans Administration, they again have, this is if you were, you are a veteran, that you served during an active time of war, then under those situations, you may be entitled to what we call an aid and attendance benefit. Now, like all good government programs, like Medicaid, it has its own specific financial eligibility rules that don't match Medicaid whatsoever. But again, those are situations only for people that are have an honorable discharge from the military, served during an active time of war. It's not a service-related type of disability that's based upon your assets. You can only have a certain amount of assets plus your home, but it's also, and then it would pay you a monthly pension if your month unreimbursed medical expenses exceed your monthly income. So now we're going to turn, I've been talking about trust and talking about the different types of trust that we can, that are available, that if the assets are in these trusts, then the assets in the trust will not be counted against you for determining Medicaid eligibility. And we broadly categorize those trusts as special needs trusts. But we have to divide special needs trust into two separate categories here. The first category is what we define these by looking at the source of funds. So if the source of funds are for someone other than the person applying for Medicaid, we call that a third-party special needs trust, or it's called a supplemental needs trust. There's all sorts of terms for them, you know, and if you go to the laws that authorizes to create these trusts, they don't mention the term special needs trust or supplemental needs trust. Those are just terms that have been used to describe these trusts. But with third-party trusts, the money's coming from somebody else other than the Medicaid applicant. So if the source of the funds are from the Medicaid applicant, then we have to do a different type of special needs trust, and that's typically categorized as a self-settled or a first-party special needs trust, or more familiar, most of those are, they'll be referred to as what we call Medicaid payback trust, and I'll talk about those in more detail here shortly. So a third-party trust, meaning that the money is coming from somebody else. For example, a trust is established by the well spouse for the benefit of the spouse who may have the diagnosis, or for a parent for a child, or for a grandparent for a grandchild. So the money is coming from somebody else. And the key part of that is that because the person applying for Medicaid or receiving Medicaid benefits, they never received ownership of that property. It went directly from the person creating it, the parent or the spouse, into the trust. And we do that under your will, or we can transfer it to a trust that we create during the third party's lifetime. But typically it's funded when that person passes away. So because it never became the property, the Medicaid applicant never became the owner of the property, then that those assets will not be counted as property for Medicaid financial eligibility rules. So, and then the money in there can be used to supplement for what government benefits are not providing. So if somebody's receiving in-home care and you need to pay for, you know, other care providers to come in, or need to pay for transportation, or need to pay for trips, or need to pay for these other items, the money in that third-party trust, as long as it's not given directly to the Medicaid applicant, can be used to supplement what government benefits are not providing. But there's some situations where somebody doesn't, with third-party trust, that means people are going out and doing advance planning. They're coming in, talking to an elder law attorney, or a financial advisor is telling them they need to go see an attorney and do this advance planning. Or some people have their own assets already. So if they need to obtain, you know, eligibility, then there is what we call this Medicaid payback trust. But these Medicaid payback trusts have very specific rules that we have to follow and very specific terms that you have to fall with under in order to determine if you can create these trusts. For the first rule is that you have to be under the age of 65. As soon as you turn 65, that you're not allowed to put your own assets into this type of trust. It has to be established for the benefit of such individual and for the sole, but the money has to be used for that, what we call their sole benefit. And it has to be established by a parent, grandparent, legal guardian, or court. Meaning that doesn't mean that we're using the parent, grandparent, or courts or legal guardian's money. Those are the people that have to establish the trust or create it. We're still using the Medicaid applicant's money. But then upon the death of the Medicaid applicant, the state, which provided medical services, has to be reimbursed out of that trust to the extent there's money in there. So I think it's much easier if we kind of, you know, walk through an example here, and that will help us explain these types of trusts. So Donald is 50 years old, has an MS, and he has $200,000 in savings. He has been rapidly spending his money on his care and is concerned that he'll soon run out of funds. Donald's elderly mother, Sarah, wants to provide for his care after she passes away, but is concerned on making the money last for his benefit. So Sarah goes to an attorney and creates a third-party trust under her will for Donald's benefit. The trust created by Sarah in her will provides that the money is to use to supplement what government benefits do not provide for Donald. Upon Donald's passing, any remaining funds pass to Donald's children, and Sarah names her daughter Rebecca as the trustee of Donald's trust. A first-party special needs trust is created for Donald's benefit. Donald, because this is the $200,000 was his money, he transfers his $200,000 into the trust and names his sister Rebecca as the trustee. Donald's first-party special needs trust requires that upon Donald's passing, the state that provided Medicaid services to Donald be reimbursed to the extent of medical service that he received. After Sarah's passing, Rebecca is trustee of both of the third-party trusts created by Sarah and the first-party trust created for Donald's benefit. Donald is eligible for Medicaid benefits because he is disabled and he's otherwise financially eligible. Because we transferred his $200,000 in there, he could still own his home, but his bank account is now below $2,000. Because Sarah had the foresight to go out and do advanced planning, there's no payback is required from the trust that she created under her will. Rebecca uses the money from Donald's first-party payback trust prior to using the money in Sarah's trust. Because Sarah did advanced planning, Donald is still qualified for Medicaid, and she protected that money that was in that trust for Donald's benefit for her grandchildren, because that trust will then pass without a payback provision to her grandchildren. So when we're talking about all this, we want to make sure, we want to focus, we want to talk to an attorney that understands all of these rules and then make decisions about who we're going to place in charge in case we become incapacitated. If we're married, you're going to have your well spouse create the marital special needs trust in case they pass away first. We're going to make sure that we've got our financial power of attorney documents in place. And if you have your own assets and you're not married and you're under age 65, then we're going to create this first-party special needs trust or talk about the other options that are available for you to make sure that you can qualify for Medicaid benefits if you need assistance in your home or need assistance with paying for long-term care. So I know all of these rules are very complicated, and all of these programs have all of these different financial eligibility rules. That's why it's important to contact an elder law attorney. You can go to the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys website and search for one. Talking to people like Dick, making sure that your financial affairs is always of critical importance, and making sure too, when you have these savings, that these savings accounts are invested in doing what they need to do for you. And then we've also put up the information for the all of the great resources at the MS Society. So Doris, I'm going to turn it back over to you at this time.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. And so for those of you that are participating tonight, don't go crazy trying to write down all of these resources. The slide deck is available on our website, and if you registered and provided an email address, you received that link, and so you can download that from there. I think the most important thing, though, is, you know, if you contact an MS Navigator, that's a good way to access all of this other stuff. So having said that, we are moving now into our question and answer period. So, Cersei, we are ready to begin taking questions. You can either, for those of you who are on a telephone line, Cersei will help you to be able to state your question. For those of you who are online, you can text your questions in the chat box that is on the bottom left-hand side of your screen. I am monitoring those questions and queuing them up. And so while Cersei queues up any telephone questions, I'm going to go ahead and start with a couple of questions that we got via the chat feature. So one of the first questions that we have, and Brad, this is related to particularly the Medicaid long-term care programs. So I'm sure a lot of people have heard about, you know, having to spend down in order to qualify for some of those programs. So I was wondering if you could touch a little bit on how kind of special needs trust can factor in to having to spend down in order to qualify for those benefits.
Well, again, if you're a single person, then, you know, we talked about you can keep your exempt resources, you know, your house and your vehicle and those exempt resources that I had listed. If you're under the age of 65, we typically don't, if you need to go out and, you know, and buy certain things, we may advise you about that. But if you're under age 65, we always want to try to preserve your money. So that's why we would put them in to that first party special needs trust. And that now that trust will have that payback provision after you pass away, but it will allow you to get immediate eligibility, and that's what the trade-off is, getting immediate eligibility in exchange for that payoff that would occur when you pass away. Now, if there's no money left in the trust when you pass away, there's no payback. But that's how we look at that, because I'm always very careful about telling people to, you know, Dick has been telling you to save all your money and then you don't want to go, and all of a sudden you're being told to go spend down. So we want to do that, you know, in the correct way. If you're married, again, depending on your program, then typically we are transferring the assets to the spouse. There's no penalty for transferring assets to a spouse, and there's no penalty converting them from a countable resource to an exempt property. So again, those rules allow us to protect property depending on your situation. If you're over 65 and you're single, then depending on your state, then we have a little bit more of a difficulty situation. We may be transferring your assets and waiting out a penalty period, or we may be converting them into exempt resources. Each state's going to have some specific rules that allow you to what we call protect your assets.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right, another question from the chat. How do I find a financial advisor or an attorney that I can afford to discuss these items and services with?
Well, let me take on the financial advisor question part of this. What we have is these Financial Education Partners program that the National MS Society has entered into with the Society for Financial Service Professionals. And one could access that through the navigators, et cetera. I'm the national director of that program, and I've probably counseled 200 MS patients myself on a pro bono basis. So you can certainly get good financial planning advice and direction without paying for it. Legal fees, probably a different issue. Maybe Brad could address that.
Well, what I would suggest, you know, we talked about, we gave you the link to the NALA, National Academy of Elder Law Attorney website, and you can do a search to find an attorney. You should look for an attorney that's a certified elder law attorney that understand special needs trust, and they'll typically will have in a directory there about what their emphases are for that attorney, then you should contact that attorney's office to ask them about what they would charge for an initial consultation, what they would, you know, and most of the attorneys will work, depending on what they're going to do with you, on a flat fee basis. So when clients walk into my office or we meet with clients, then, you know, at that consultation, we're going to figure out what we're going to do. And then we're going to tell you, you know, based upon that, what our fees are up front before you proceed. And any good attorney, experienced attorney, is going to do that. They're going to make sure that you know what your fees are or know how you're going to be charged before you start. And that's part of the questions you should be asking when you're talking to and trying to determine, you know, calling in and an attorney that's, you know, a good office will, you know, let you know that, talk to you about that, and be very upfront with you on those fees.
Okay, great, thank you. Cersei, are there any telephone questions that you would like to start with, or should I continue with some chat questions?
Oh, well, let me give instructions here. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to register for a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. Again, to register for an audio question, please press 1-4. And just one moment for our first question.
I'm going to go ahead and work on another chat question while you queue a telephone question up. So what are some options for a single person with Medicare who is not poor enough to qualify for Medicaid, but is not rich enough to be able to pay for in-home care on their own? So kind of that trap that a lot of people can fall into.
That's where a lot of people do fall into about that. And again, I think if you kind of walk through, and if you're a single person, you know, I often say that, you know, it's really unfortunate these rules are, you know, you could go out and, you know, and gamble your money away and the Medicaid office wouldn't care about that. But if you gave it to somebody, then all of a sudden you're penalized for that. So again, you're looking at maximizing what your exempt resources are, or creating that trust to get your, you know, what the asked money that's counted is countable down below that number. So again, an attorney will, in your state, depending on what your rules are, will explain what all of your options are for that. Because in-home care and that cost of long-term care, that can, you know, be so expensive and can spin down your assets so rapidly. That's why it's important to get that information, know what your options are, before you're in a situation where you spent down your money and now you don't have very many choices whatsoever.
Okay. Cersei, are there any telephone line questions?
Yes, we do have some questions. Our first question comes from the line of Jennifer. Please proceed with your question.
Hi. I was wondering whether any people ever open custodial accounts for their children as a way to protect assets until their children are majors or 21, meaning, like, if I set up a custodial account for my daughter, could I use those assets for us and then what remains there pass to my daughter when she's 21? And
well,
would that be
If you use those assets, if you put up in the custodial account and then you use those assets for yourself, when your daughter turned 21 and she found out that the money wasn't there, then she could see an attorney and bring an action against you for spending her money. Because a custodial account means you've transferred ownership. And if you've transferred ownership, then that also has those adverse, rules that Medicaid looks at. They presume every transfer was made for the purposes of qualifying for Medicaid. So creating custodial accounts, and will be looked at as a transfer, and that is now your daughter's money. And at age 21, whether she used it for good purposes or not the right thing, it's her money.
Okay, thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, to register for a question, please press 1-4. And the next question comes from the line of Lisa. Please proceed with your question.
Yes. Wanted to know, going back on the Social Security and disability and stuff like that, what I wanted to know was, is there any assistance as far as, the government things. I'm married and I have a child, but I'm struggling really bad, financial. And I didn't know if there was anything as far as, long-term disability or short-term disability or whichever you may say, to help me out currently.
Are you disabled?
No, I've been working full time the last 5 years that I had MS.
Yeah, what state are you in?
New Jersey.
Okay, now New Jersey is one of the 5 states that has a state disability program.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, this would give you benefits if you're disabled. Social Security will provide no benefits. Unless you're disabled for at least 5 months and have your disability expect to last for 12 months or end in your prior death, it would be easier to qualify for a disability benefit in New Jersey, I'm sure. But in the absence of having disability, Social Security is not designed to step in effect as a welfare program to help you out.
Right.
Brad, can you add to that?
Yeah, I mean, especially, Lisa, if you're working, I think Dick was very, to tell you about the program, and that may be available. But when you're working, and earning income, and, then that generally would preclude you from other type of assistance from, whether that's, Section 8 housing, food stamps, or any of those other types of, LEAP benefits and things like that, depending on your state. So typically all of those types of, those types of benefits that may be paid, those are financially based based upon your income and your assets. And like Dick said, Social Security, you have to have that disability trigger for whether it's Social Security disability, SSI, for those to start.
Okay. Thank you.
And our next question comes from the line of Rosette. Please proceed with your question.
Hi. My question involves the self-settled special needs trust that you spoke about. I believe it was Brad who mentioned that that you were able to pass the money onto your grandchildren without paying back Medicaid. I'm not sure. I kind of missed, the gist of that. Can you please re-explain that?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't the self-settled. That was the example I was using this for where, and the example I used, it was Donald's mother. It was the third-party trust. So somebody else used their own money to create that trust. And under that type of situation where somebody else, you're using somebody else's money to create the trust for the benefit of the person applying for Medicaid, there is no what we call Medicaid payback when the Medicaid applicant dies. So those type of trusts do not have a payback provision, and it can pass on to, if we designate it to go to, grandchildren or other siblings, we can put that into the document. It's when you use the Medicaid's own money, where it's their money already in their bank account or assets that's already in their name, then that's the self-settled payback trust that once the Medicaid applicant, the person that money we use to create the trust, once they pass away, that's when Medicaid has to be repaid. So it's important when you're talking about those trusts to differentiate between, you know, whose money was used. So if it's somebody else's money that they're doing advanced planning, then there's no payback provision. But if you're in a situation where you didn't do advanced planning, then the Medicaid applicant inherited the money or they had their own assets, then there's that payback trust, and that does require the state be reimbursed when that person passes away.
Okay, now can I ask a second part of the question then? You said something about you can't transfer resources except to a spouse. Now, am I allowed to transfer my savings to my parents, let's say? Wait, what is it, a five-year look-back for Medicaid?
5 years for long-term care, 3 years for SSI.
Okay, so I'm looking for long-term care or help in the household.
Mm-hmm.
So that would
and
be...
And again, you would look, you know, your state may have specific rules to deal with that, but generally it's a five-year look-back period. So I could transfer $1 million and wait 5 years and one day and then be fine as long as I, you know, had less than $2,000 at that time.
So if I was able to transfer my savings, which is kicking me out of a Medicaid program, to a brother or a parent or whatever, and then they set up, can a brother set up a special needs trust for me? Or it has to be just a parent or spouse.
Your brother cannot. I mean, the brother could say you're going to transfer it to your brother, and then he's going to, you know, if he would die before you, he puts it into a trust for your benefit. But again, if you're going to make the transfer, you obviously need to be careful who you transfer this money to. But then you've got to wait out that penalty period. If you don't want to wait out the penalty period and you're under age 65, then you put it into that Medicaid payback trust.
And then even to have an aide come to the house to help with, you know, household chores or whatever, you have to pay that back too, right?
Well, it's medical services. It's only medical services provide, but that's typically part of the medical services.
So my question is, if I transfer the money and I can wait the 5 years, who is allowed to open a trust for me? It cannot only be my parents, which may
but you
not
don't
be
you don't need you don't need a trust at that time for yourself because you've transferred away the money. Now, if you transferred it to your parents, you got to assume that they're going to pass away first, and then
right.
They would put that money in a trust for your benefit, and there would be no payback provision.
Okay.
Well, go read through those examples, and then I think that'll help you.
Right. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay, Cersei, I'm going to jump in with an online question. Do you need a certain amount of credits within the last 10 years, so work credits, for Social Security disability?
Yes.
Yes, you really have to have 50. You have to have half of your last 10 years. Correct, Brad?
Correct. And if you haven't worked for more than 10 years, you're not going to get Social Security disability.
Yeah, the fact that you might have worked from ages 25 to 35, quit the workforce to become a full-time mom and have MS at age 55 does not mean you're going to get – you're fully qualified for a Social Security retirement benefit, but you are not qualified for a disability benefit.
Okay. Cersei, are there any other calls on the telephone line?
We do have a follow-up question from the line of Jennifer.
Okay.
Please proceed with your question.
Can you comment on states that may have a spousal obligation to pay for any medical creditors and how that might impact how you would transfer money? And as a follow-on question, how would you how do you transfer assets or transfer large sums of money from one person to another without paying taxes on that? Or are those always taxable transactions?
Well, there's, you know, you're right about the that there are, you know, a lot of states have, you know, rules that make spouses responsible for medical necessities. But again, that's under, you know, that means that you're not under Medicaid rules. So, you know, if somebody doesn't have complete medical insurance or they don't have medical insurance, they go out and incur large hospital doctor bills, then certain states' laws may make the other spouse just as liable for those expenses. From a tax perspective, that a transfer, you know, when we talk about transfer of assets, that's a gift. And under the, you know, the gift tax rules are completely different than Medicaid rules. So I'm allowed to what we have, what we call a gift tax annual exclusion. And that gift tax annual exclusion in 2014 is $14,000 per year per person. So I can give $14,000 to everybody on the planet and incur no gift tax. If I go over $14,000 to one person during that year, then I have what is called a applicable exclusion amount, which is now $5,340,000. So any amount above that annual exclusion will simply eat into my $5 million credit. So I would have to be making a gift of over $5 million before I would actually pay any gift tax. Now, there are some rules that can get a little bit more complicated if we are transferring appreciated property. That doesn't mean you're going to pay any tax about when you make the transfer, but if the person that you give appreciated property to, stocks, real estate, things like that, when they sell it, then they're going to have to pay income tax upon the sale. So that was probably a more detailed explanation than you wanted, but that's what those rules are. So in most gifts, for most people, it's a tax-free transaction, meaning you don't write a check to the government to transfer or give away property.
Okay. I've got one more chat question. With respect to transferring assets and looking at it, you know, for the trust rules, are there differences for couples that reside in a common law state?
Not for Medicaid purposes. It doesn't matter. You know, again, Medicaid rules are state specific, but it's not related to whether you're community property or common law.
Okay. All right. Cersei, are there any last calls on the telephone line?
No, Ms. Lill, we had no further questions from the phone lines.
Okay, wonderful. Then we're going to go ahead and wrap up. I do have some quick polling questions that I'm going to put on the screen now. If everyone will take a moment to answer them, please do not answer them in the chat feature. Click in the middle of your screen and answer the question. And so the first question on your screen is, did you learn something new from this presentation? Okay. All right, we're going to go ahead and move on to the next question. Was the material presented relevant to you? Please click in the center of your screen and answer the question. Okay, next question. Were the speakers and the information they presented easy to understand? Okay. Do you anticipate contacting a financial planner or attorney as a result of this presentation? Okay. Are you a partner, a family member, or a person with MS? Okay. And that concludes our presentation this evening. I want to thank Dick and Brad for joining us and putting together such a fantastic presentation. Also, a reminder that a recording of this presentation and a copy of the PowerPoint and some additional articles that that we've gathered are available on our website. You received that link in your confirmation email. You can always call us, though, and ask to be pointed to that. And that concludes our call this evening. Thank you so much.